Welcome to Byline. I'm Gabe Bullard in for Rick Howlett. On Tuesday, lawmakers will return to Frankfurt for another legislative session. It's a short one, just 30 days, but Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston will be there for all of them. Before he decamps to the Capitol, though, we asked him to come to our studio. Kenny, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a few big issues. Like I said, it is this short session. A lot of issues coming up on the table that we're hearing more and more about each day as this approaches. I guess the top one is gambling.
Yeah, I mean, gambling is probably always going to be an issue on the table until they pass it, or I guess until Governor Steve Beshear is term limited, which would be another, I guess, 2 or 3 years from now. So that's been bounded around a little bit. And the other top issue that's pressing is pension reform.
Well, on this gambling issue, the thing that everyone's saying has changed this year is that David Williams is no longer president of the Senate. He has been appointed to a judgeship by Governor Beshear. Also, the governor is now saying that he would support what they're calling a clean gambling bill that wouldn't necessarily require any casinos to be in Churchill Downs. What do those two things change about the likelihood that this could pass this year after so many times that it failed?
I think the David Williams part of it is not as important. I mean, there were a lot of votes against the gambling amendment. David Williams obviously was a big foe to that. You know, he made them probably jump over 5 extra hurdles that they may not have jumped over. And also, he was really good at keeping the Republican caucus together. And so that's one issue. I think that's a smaller issue, though. The clean amendment obviously is the bigger issue. When the Republican Senate rejected it last year, you heard from a lot of Republican senators who had publicly said that they would support expanded gambling. You heard them say that basically what they were doing is they were going to vote against the bill that has been presented last time because it had that 60-mile radius where you couldn't have a casino 60 miles within a horse track or racing track. So they basically voted against it. That's what killed the bill last time. If you bring a clean amendment, you probably have the votes. And the question is, does the horse racing industry trust the governor that enabling legislation will protect them, or do they try to sabotage a clean amendment?
And we'll put this in the show notes for Byline, but it's also on WFPL.org right now, WFPL.org, that Mayor Greg Fisher says if gambling is legalized and if casinos could be freestanding, that he would put one, he would be willing to support one in downtown Louisville. He's obviously not building it or opening it, but he says that he would support one downtown. You mentioned pension reform as something else. That's something we've heard a lot about, even in national publications, saying how bad these public employee pensions are. What's the likelihood that there's going to be a fix to this? The pensions are underfunded, essentially.
Yeah, I think it's very likely. The question that they are going to have to figure out is how do you pay for what the system that you've been underfunding for so long? They had a task force over the summer that came back with a host of recommendations, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of debate over the recommendations. One of those is that you start fully paying into this pension system what state government owes it. The other one being that, you know, they put new hires into what's called a cash hybrid balance system. It's got a lot of weird names, but basically what it is it's the old system and a hybrid 401k plan together. All those recommendations seem to be a slam dunk. The question is where do you find the millions or billions of dollars that the pension system is underfunded to pay for it? And that's their big debate.
The other things we saw task forces formed for were liquor laws, revising those, and tax reform. What are the odds either of those are going to happen in the next month?
I think tax reform is probably very unlikely. You're not going to see those recommendations taken as a whole, but you may see a few as revenue boosters. Liquor laws, they're going to have to do something. A federal judge has basically struck down the majority of the state's liquor laws and made it open season. He stayed that in hoping that the General Assembly would write new ones. And if they don't get new ones, they're going to basically have open season. You'll have liquor and wine in gas stations and everywhere else.
Right, because right now you can only sell beer in grocery stores. You could sell liquor and wine in drug stores. You could sell liquor, wine, and beer. You could sell it all in certain places, but not in grocery stores.
Exactly. And I think what the lawmakers will have to do is find some sort of uniform system where if CVS has wine, then Kroger needs to be able to sell wine. The question is, can they get together enough of a coalition to pass a law like that?
All right, we'll see what happens. We'll be checking in with you throughout the session. Kenny, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if you didn't watch Wednesday's Sugar Bowl, that's a football game, in case you didn't know, you undoubtedly heard about it and the University of Louisville Cardinals upset over the Florida Gators. Whether through boasts from U of L fans on Facebook or Twitter, the stunned silence of UK fans like Kenny Colston, or through the hoarse voice of that coworker who got to the office oddly late the next day. To discuss what this win means for the school and the city, here's a man who's never late to work, Joseph Lord.
Hey,
thanks
hey,
for
Gabe.
Being here.
Hey, Gabe.
So this was a big upset. Sports analysts overwhelmingly picked Florida to win. Louisville was, what, the 14-point underdog here?
Yeah, they were a 14-point underdog. There was a sense that Louisville was very overmatched in this game. Florida finished the regular season the number three-ranked team in the BCS rankings, which determines who plays in the national championship game. So from that, you can divine that Florida's the best team in the country not playing for a national title this year.
And so what does this mean now that Louisville has won for the program and for Louisville, the host city here?
Well, there's the overwhelming opinion, I think, locally especially, is that this may be the biggest game, the biggest victory Louisville's ever had. The after effects of that are, one, especially considering that Charlie Strong isn't leaving. Louisville fans will definitely remember the last time they won one of these big games, Bobby Petrino, the then coach, bailed for the Atlanta Falcons. But since he's staying, quarterback Teddy Bridgewater is going to be back. They should be in line for a pretty solid ranking in next season. And that could elevate them to national championship contender even.
And that leads also, though, to more TV exposure for the team. I mean, how many U of L football games were on major channels here? Any ESPNs without a number after them, major broadcast networks, anything like that?
They had a few, but this Sugar Bowl was the only football game on that night. It was the Mayor Fisher yesterday when he was here. He discussed that. He mentioned that as a benefit for the city. It was basically 4 hours of U of L. What's more interesting is that Florida fans didn't seem to show up to this game. I've read that it was the least attended Sugar Bowl in since the 30s. And but Louisville fans filled the arena. They were by far the majority of people who were in the Superdome for this game. And so therefore it really reflected well on the university. It could help with recruiting. It could, as I said, could help with their preseason ranking next year. And if they have a good season, anything's possible.
Does it all hinge, though, on a good season next year to make to show that this isn't a fluke? And if that good season happens, then what happens for the team?
Well, the thing that made this game really important for U of L is they just don't often play a lot of top teams in the elite level. Florida is an elite team. Kentucky hasn't beaten this team in 26 tries, and the idea is that because they were able to beat an elite team, they've joined the elite. And but yeah, they're gonna have to play well next season. They're gonna be in the Big East, hypothetically easier competition still for one more year at least. So we'll see.
All right, Joe Lord, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
When we come back, Decode DC explores the interplay of politics in the media and how press coverage can feed into the negative partisan bickering in Washington. Case in point, the fiscal cliff. That's in 1 minute on Byline. My
bowl. Support for WFPL comes from the Y, always moving to strengthen our community's health and well-being, with programs and membership for all that are designed to help those who join the YMCA to be moved to make a difference. Information at ymcalouisville.org.
You're listening to Byline on 89.3. WFPL, Louisville's NPR News station. WFPL News is partnering with the Community Foundation of Louisville and Chase to explore public education through in-depth reporting and community conversation. We invite you to take part and share your experience. Go to WFPL.org and click on The Next Louisville. Coming up later this afternoon on WFPL, It's Science Friday. We'll be taking a look back at some of the biggest science stories of 2012. We'll also look at some unusual animal adaptations, a trip to the clouds where comets are born as well. That's Science Friday coming up this afternoon, beginning at 2 o'clock on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Byline. I'm Gabe Bullard, in for Rick Howlett. You've probably noticed that the more feverish coverage of a political issue gets, the more politicians end up matching that attitude. Case in point, the fiscal cliff. Andrea Seabrook with Decode DC has a look at this phenomenon.
This is Decode DC. I'm Andrea Seabrook.
You know, I'm pretty tired of legislation by hysteria.
Wow, you know, my taxes went up. I don't have as much money in my paycheck. What happened?
Today on the show, we are not talking about the fiscal cliff because it's over. Crisis averted. Good job, Congress. Oh, wait. You mean they just put it off? They didn't actually solve anything?
And so bad, hysterical, do it or drop dead kind of moments lead to more bad, do it or drop dead kind of moments.
Seriously, though, there are some good reasons why Washington is such a snarled mess right now.
I don't think since before the Civil War you've had people so vehemently opposed to each other sharing power.
But there are also some bad reasons, things that make no sense at all, like leaders keeping their own lawmakers in the dark.
And it's also, you know, the confusion around the fact that you don't know what the hell's going on.
And maybe, just maybe, the media coverage itself could be part of the problem.
Decode DC is a small independent news organization, and we're funded by you, our listeners. Help us out at decodedc.com. Major support for this show comes from Andrews and Dunham, the makers of Damn Fine Tea, small batch, artisan blends of loose leaf tea in beautifully designed custom tins. Order online at damnfinetea.com.
This is Decode DC. I'm Andrea Seabrook. I don't know about you, but I have a pretty wild case of PTSD. Not the kind that real people develop from real war or violence against them. More like congressional PTSD, partisan traumatic stress disorder. It comes from this whole ridiculous episode in Washington we journalists have been following for 2 full years now, starting with the government shutdown, then the debt ceiling crisis, the super committee and its failure, and of course, the most recent incarnation, the fiscal cliff.
Today, real questions at this hour about whether the Senate passed fiscal cliff legislation.
And breaking news.
All eyes on the House of Representatives as we await some action on the fiscal cliff deal. We
this
are
is
live.
A pretty critical moment for the country. We are talking about 12 hours after the deadline for the government action.
It might seem like this fiscal cliff business was a separate and distinct fight from all the other ones I mentioned. The news media sure cover it as if it's just the next crisis rolling along. But that's not true. This is one big crisis. 2 years of nonstop, knockdown, drag-out partisan fighting, tooth and claw. Now, if you, like I, have PTSD about this, then you'll understand my reluctance to cover the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations. In fact, before the election, I vowed never to cover the mess again. After a year and a half of covering that fight, I had come to the realization that the media coverage of it is almost as bad as the partisan fighting itself. I didn't want to be part of the problem. That's not why I became a journalist. And it's one thing I vowed not to do here on Decode DC. But by the end of 2012, it became crystal clear that I couldn't talk about Washington, how it works, how it doesn't, without talking about the whole fiscal cliff mess. And so here we are, the first show of the year, talking about why we don't want to talk about the fiscal cliff. Super meta, right? That's how we came to the title of this show, The Unshow. In the last week of December, in the thick of negotiations, my producer Lena Misitsis and I trudged up to Capitol Hill. What we found there was a normal day. Members of Congress voting on the House floor, coming out into the ornate lobby to be swarmed by the press, reporters eager to get the story. On that day, it was John Boehner's incredibly short-lived Plan B. Here's Texas Republican Ted Poe being grilled by the swarm.
Well, it doesn't deal with the issues, some other issues, like spending. But it does deal with taxes, tax rates.
So it's fair to say you're leaning towards supporting it.
No, I haven't decided. But I'm just saying that that's a good
point. Do you think Boehner can have his 218 votes that he needs?
I don't know.
Really? Why is that?
Because I'm not on the whip team. I don't know how they whipped it.
What did you think about Plan A? What did you think about Speaker Boehner's proposal that was floated over the weekend?
Now, did you hear how deep into the minutiae reporters' questions were? The focus on every twitch of John Boehner's left pinky? The reason for that is, well, this is a crisis, right? The public needs to know.
I think once that tone got set, that's the pace that we've been on.
Raul Grijalva is a Democrat from Arizona, and he points out something you may have forgotten. The name of this news event, the fiscal cliff, was created by the media itself.
And it has kind of like that Thelma and Louise movie where we're going to go over the cliff regardless. And so once the media picked cliff up as the byword, with all the implications to it, it became kind of we're racing toward the end.
Grijalva noticed that by mid-December, the cable news networks had revved up their countdown clocks, applying a steady pressure to the negotiations. Crisis, impending doom.
A holiday high wire act in Washington. The country technically does go over the fiscal cliff.
Live coverage of the so-called fiscal cliff talks.
Deadline just barely. The Senate has passed a deal to avoid the fiscal cliff.
And that now goes to the House for a vote.
Now, I know. I can hear some of you out there saying, wait a second. The media didn't create this crisis. The Tea Party did, right? Well, yes and no. It is true that when a huge wave of tough conservative Republicans came to town in early 2011, pretty much all productivity in Congress came to a halt. The GOP had control of the House, and they immediately used that power to stall bills that were once very basic, business as usual in Congress. Passing a budget, funding the government, paying the bills. And in many ways, Republicans were successful with this tactic. They used their new power to ratchet down spending over time and to completely block any increases in government spending at all. So yes, says former Democratic congressman and now just regular person Barney Frank, the Tea Party is part of Congress's gridlock problem.
We haven't done much constructive in these 2 years because the House of Representatives is controlled by people who don't believe in governance and don't want to do anything constructive.
I caught Barney Frank walking up the drive to the Capitol on one of his last days there before retirement, and he described just how vast the partisan divide is right now.
No, I have not seen, I don't think, since before the Civil War, you've had people so vehemently opposed to each other sharing power, and in particular, you have this very conservative group that don't believe in governance.
Frank said it wasn't like this back when the Democrats controlled Congress and George W. Bush was in the White House. A huge part of the congressional gridlock is the nature of the current Republican Party itself, he said. But can you blame them? They, too, were duly elected by their constituents, who in turn hold them to exactly the steadfast, no-compromises positions they take now. I met with Maryland Democrat Elijah Cummings in his office, the walls lined with pictures of presidents and civil rights leaders. And Cummings said, people also need to remember that friction and gridlock are kind of the way Congress works, whether Democrats are in charge or Republicans are.
One of the things that people forget about Congress is that they who have power have all power. In other words, whoever's in control has all power. And so there's an effort to hold on to the power so you don't give your opponent, that is in this case the Democrats, much to work with. And the way the system is made is almost made to be dysfunctional, if you really think about it.
One thing that you can blame the current GOP for, or at least some of them, is bringing a kind of angry, tearing rhetoric to the discussion. In the lobby off the House floor, I chatted with Arizona Republican Trent Franks, and listened to how he described the Democrats' position in the debate.
I believe that the president and the left have long wished for that opportune moment to raise the taxes precipitously on the American people, to devastate the defense mechanisms of this country, and to blame the Republicans for it. What's in it for them not to like?
He refused even to acknowledge that the Democrats had any point in their arguments other than punishing American citizens. But some Democrats do this too. They call the GOP irresponsible. They don't want to do anything constructive, they say. Republicans and Democrats have hurled the most vicious, biting insults at one another that, let's just say, if they were siblings, they'd move across the country and never speak to each other again. And would that it could be so. The thing is, that kind of debate would get nowhere if the media didn't cover it, if editors and reporters decided it's not a legitimate part of the debate going on. And if you think this kind of thing doesn't happen already, just count the number of times you heard Ron Paul's ideas come up in the Republican primary. We, the media, like it or not, are often the arbiters of reasonable debate. So the reason we cover the next version of the same tired debate as crisis and impending doom is because it makes a great story.
Happening now, a fiscal cliffhanger.
A video of House Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor walking into a Republican conference meeting together.
Technically, we went over the cliff as a country, but...
What it doesn't make is great legislation.
I'm really just kind of tired of this, you know, government by crisis. And, you know, the next crisis will be the rating agencies. Oh, my God, or Wall Street is, you know, I mean, just like TARP.
This is Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio.
The last bad example of legislation by hysteria was the Republicans threatening to default on the debt of the United States. We ended up with a bad product that we're now dealing with. That's so bad, hysterical, do-it-or-drop-dead kind of moments lead to more bad, do-it-or-drop-dead kind of moments.
Making things worse is the fact that most of the lawmakers themselves have no idea what's going on in these negotiations. Grijalva says during the fiscal cliff crisis, members of Congress would mill around the House floor trying to gather any information at all.
Do you know what's going on? Have you heard anything? Is Medicare really on the table? Are they really going to raise the age? And depending on whom you're talking to, you're going to get that person's opinion. Is it factually based on something that has been said or done? Probably not.
Grijalva says he understands the pressure is so strong and the negotiations so tight that the leadership of both parties have to be discreet. But by keeping the other lawmakers completely in the dark, Grijalva is left with only one option: go on TV and take a stand through the press. It's just like what the Tea Party Republicans were doing, he says.
The members on the other side, the Tea Party folk, they're in the same situation that I'm complaining about. So they have to get on TV and talk about, we're not going to give on rates come hell or high water.
Lawmakers can't be flip-floppers. So once they've said it on TV, they can't change. And when the leadership does come to some thin, half-baked compromise, the media reward them.
It's really quite remarkable.
And when the budget deal was done, What did the media say? They avoided disaster and that there was some leadership shown there. But the fact remains that that set the scenario for where we are now. And I almost see that same replication of a hasty decision to cobble something together that'll be delicate. And then we might have to be digging a trench 6 months from now because we're back with some other crisis.
A sage prediction from Congressman Grijalva. One thing he got wrong, though, it won't be in 6 months that Washington will be back in this black hole of a problem. It'll be in 2 months. That's barely enough time for news audiences everywhere to take a break from this crisis and then be hit by the next. Decode DC is a small independent news organization. We're funded by you, our listeners. Help us out at decodedc.com. Major support for this show comes from Andrews and Dunham, the makers of Damn Fine Tea.
small batch, artisan blends of loose leaf tea in beautifully designed custom tins. We drink it, we love it, you will too. Order online at damnfinetea.com. Decode DC's producer is Lena Masitsis. Our technical consultant is Peter Seabrook. Our theme music was composed by Chris Mandra. Additional music this week from Hot Fiction and Julio y Agosto. Find them all at bandcamp.com. The show is produced on Hindenburg Journalist Pro. This is Decode DC. I'm Andrea Seabrook.
And you can hear more of the Decode DC project at decodedc.com. Amanda McDonough is a 22-year-old graduate of Cal Poly Pomona. All her life, she's had hearing problems. She wore hearing aids and hid that fact from everyone she knew. Mostly, she got by. But then, last year, everything changed. Independent radio producer Brian Calvert spent some time with Amanda and her family.
December of 2011. My goal was to get back in shape and actively pursue my acting career when I met a boy. That's not how all these stories start. He got sick. Nothing big, nothing exciting, just a normal sore throat and a cough. I don't have a very great immune system, so I ended up pretty sick. My doctor recommended that once I get a little better, I have my tonsils removed. So I did. And it was at this time when I started to notice that I couldn't really hear.
My name is Joe McDonough, and I'm Amanda's father. Amanda was in many, many musicals as she was growing up in high school. And so she always tended to get one of the main parts in the musicals. I knew that she wore hearing aids and that she had some hearing impairment, but when your daughter's playing leads in musicals, how serious could it be, right?
I'm Julie McDonough, and I am Amanda's mother. I picked up the phone, I dialed her as I always do, and she says, "Mom, I know you're there on the phone, but I can't hear you. Will you text me?"
Well, there was a falling out with the boyfriend at the time. He got sick. I took care of him. And then while I was sick, he went on a short vacation to San Francisco with a couple of his friends. And the day after he came back, he comes up to me and tells me that he cheated on me in San Francisco. So one of the first lip-reading sentences I did was, "I cheated on you in San Francisco."
Becoming deaf was a journey all of us took with her, but a lot of us declined to acknowledge. That made it harder, I think, sometimes for Amanda.
She lost her ability to hear Julie first, but she could still hear the lower end of my voice. She lost her ability to hear my wife. Of course, she says I had lost that ability too, but...
When I became deaf, it was almost a relief. I spent my entire life being afraid of losing any more of my hearing. I spent my entire life praying every night, "Please don't let it get any worse. Please don't let it get any worse." And when it was finally all gone, I was just kind of like, "All right, now what do I do?"
Hi, it's Jane.
Your 1 o'clock patient is in.
Thanks, Sally.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay. I'm Jane Gay, a clinical audiologist in the Adult Cochlear Implant Program at House Clinic in Los Angeles. She came in and she was very, very clear that she hadn't made up her mind if this was the direction she wanted to go in. She said, "I'm just trying to accept that this has happened to me." Here we go. 10 to 20-25% of implant users are able to enjoy music. You recognize that. That's from the Nutcracker. But unfortunately, not everybody. So now I'm going to play. This is just bare bones cochlear implant.
I could see it at first when she came out of that appointment and she hadn't made a final decision. And she was like crying one second and happy the other.
I was like, I'm going to get it. And I slammed my hands down on the table and I was like, I'm not going to think about it anymore. I'm not going to overthink it. I'm getting it. And we're not talking about it anymore. And she's like, okay.
So tomorrow I am scheduled for my cochlear implant surgery at 9 a.m. I have my last meeting with my surgeon, Dr. House.
Good morning.
How are you all?
We were joking the other day at lunch about how, like, you can watch ESPN before a game and find out if a player's knee is bothering them. You can try and tell whether or not they're going to play as well that day. I wish they did that with surgeons.
The surgery itself will take about an hour to an hour and a half. When you come out of surgery, you'll go to a recovery room for about an hour. In about 3 weeks, she'll receive her external processor.
Thanks so much, Dr. House.
You're very welcome. And I will see you all this afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to meet you. I'm Dr. Lee. Anesthesiologist.
Nice to meet you.
I'm the one main guy put you to sleep and wake you up. You're alive in my hand now.
It smells like peppermint.
Okay, good night. Bye.
The sound will come in just like it normally does. It hits the eardrum and goes through the little ear bones. It vibrates the fluid. But there's no little sensors there to sense the vibration. So what happens is the sound doesn't get transmitted onto the brain. So what's internal is the receiver and the electrodes. The external processor is where the computer is that takes sound, processes the sound, converts the sound to an electrical message, causes the electrodes then to stimulate the hearing nerve itself.
Coming out of the anesthesia was not fun. A couple of days I had a little bit of difficulty with the recovery. I was really dizzy. There was pain. It's 2 days before the outer piece of my cochlear implant gets put on. And I am really nervous. I've started becoming frustrated. Been trying to communicate with my own family members, and I started kind of isolating myself a little more than usual. Yesterday, my uncle came over, my aunt was here, my grandmother, my parents, my brother. Everyone's sitting around our kitchen table. They're talking and having grand old time, and I couldn't keep up. I couldn't figure out who was talking when. I got so frustrated, my eyes started to water, and I just walked out of the house and went for a walk because I couldn't. Because in my life, I'm alone in this, and I know they try, I really, really do, but they'll never understand what it's like to be me. To live in a world that is completely silent all the time and where you feel utterly and completely alone.
Okay. I'm going to turn this on. It's going to give you a little bit of a jolt in the beginning.
A jolt?
You'll see. It'll take just a couple seconds before it kicks on.
I feel this weird kind of like vibration.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, can you hear my voice?
Wow, that
sounds... Do you hear my voice? Does it sound weird?
It sounds like a robot.
A robot, that's okay. Do you hear words?
Not really.
Is my voice far, far away, or is it right here in the room?
Oh my God, it just changed.
Okay. Is my voice right here in the room, or is it far, far away?
It's a little far away, but I can hear words now.
Okay. It's going to get better and better. I just made my voice come in a little bit closer. Is that a little better?
Kind of.
Okay. And you're understanding me.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Here.
Sorry.
That's okay. Everybody cries. Even I do. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it?
Wow. I haven't heard somebody say a word in so long.
I know. Come here. Oh.
Got it? Yes, I can hear the phone ring now. Which is exciting. I got bubble wrap the other day. I was putting my diploma in its frame, and the frame was covered in bubble wrap. So I take the bubble wrap off, and I accidentally popped one. I was like, oh my gosh, what is that? So then, of course, I have to lay down on the floor and, like, start pounding them out. My mom thought I was a little crazy. She's sitting here watching TV, and I'm sitting on the floor of the living room, 22 years old, popping bubble wrap like a 5-year-old child with my eyes wide and all excited. So that's what it's been like. Every day I get a new sound, and then I have to learn it and memorize it and understand it. Music is actually starting to sound a little better. When it comes to, like, music I know, like, from the past, music I'm really familiar with, it starts sounding a little more like music. I'm deaf. I'm always going to be deaf. The second this thing comes off, the second it runs out of batteries, I hear nothing. Nothing at all. Complete silence. And sometimes I really like that. Sounds can be overwhelming. Like, people talking can get annoying. Sometimes I just like to take it off just because, you know what, I could use some silence for a few minutes.
The Rest is Silence was originally produced for Unfictional on KCRW, Santa Monica. It was produced by Brian Calvert and mixed by Bob Carlson. The editor was Jacob Conrad. You can hear more at WFPL.org. You're listening to Byline on WFPL.
Support for WFPL comes from the Louisville Orchestra, presenting Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade January 11th at Whitney Hall. Included in the program, a Louisville Orchestra commission, Sidereus by Osvaldo Golioff, and Andrea Levine performs Weber's Clarinet Concerto. Tickets and information at 584-7777 or louisvilleorchestra.org.
You're listening to Byline on 89.3 WFPL, Louisville's NPR news station. Louisville's future depends on strong public education. To take this on, WFPL News is partnering with the Community Foundation of Louisville and Chase for the next Louisville Public Education. We encourage you to join the initiative and be part of the solution. Share your ideas and look for our in-depth reports. Go to WFPL.org and click on The Next Louisville. Coming up later today on Science Friday, we're going to be taking a look back at the biggest science stories of 2012. That's Science Friday at 2 this afternoon on WFPL.
At its height, 40 years ago, the General Electric plant in Louisville employed 23,000 people. But then the plant began to shrink, laying off more and more employees. And like other manufacturing giants, it followed the outsourcing trend, sending jobs overseas, especially to China. By 2011, GE bottomed out with less than 1,900 jobs in the Louisville plant. But in February of last year, something began to change. New jobs were created. A new assembly line opened, the first since 1955. All of this was reported in a story in the Atlantic Monthly by Charles Fishman. It's called The Insourcing Boom. And it began with GE bringing a home water heater, a simple appliance they've made for years. But as Fishman explains to WFPL's Jonathan Bastian, that's only the beginning of the story.
This water heater is called a GeoSpring, GeoSpring, and it's designed to be extremely energy efficient, and it actually uses 40% less energy than a typical water heater, but still makes your water hot. And GE was making it in China, and with transportation costs, with the housing market about to start coming back, and the desire to sell water heaters quickly wherever in the country, housing started to pop back up. The folks at GE Appliances and the business is headquartered in Louisville. It's not just the manufacturing that's there,
right,
but the actual decision-making is there, decided to try and bring that water heater home. And in the process of bringing it home, not only were they able to make it in Louisville as inexpensively as in China, they actually figured out how to make it cheaper. So the water heater that cost $1,500 at Home Depot or Lowe's when it was made in China only costs $1,200
right.
now.
Right.
So it's made in the U.S. by U.S. workers and a U.S. company, and it is actually less expensive than it was when it was made in China. And that kind of cracked open the world for them.
Yeah. There are a number of reasons that you write about as to why this happened. And why don't you begin with this list here? It looks like there's five or six major points. And one of the first one is that oil prices are three times what they were in the year 2000. And you write, making cargo ship fuel more expensive now than it was then. So fuel prices is one issue here.
Right. Fuel prices are important just so people understand, because you're putting the stuff on the boat and it's going to spend 5 weeks getting from China to Los Angeles, and if the fuel, you know, that's the only cost to getting it here is the fuel, really. So that, and then energy prices in the U.S. have actually, particularly natural gas, has come down dramatically.
Right.
And a factory like this GE facility, factories can typically pick the kind of fuel they use because they're such big users, and they love natural gas, and this factory's natural gas costs a quarter what fuel costs in Asia, so that helps. The ability to move quickly has become more and more important all the time. 20 years ago, the appliance design cycle was 7 years or more. They just put out basically the same thing year after year for 7 years. Now, because of the sort of the iPhone phenomenon and the computer phenomenon and the laptop phenomenon, people want new stuff. So that design cycle has really tightened up to 3 years or even less. You can't really afford to have your products in transit for 5 or 6 or 7 weeks. You know, they hit the port and they got to keep going. That's a significant amount of the entire life cycle of the product.
Yeah. On top of that, you also write that wages in China are five times what they were in 2000. So we're also just getting, it's more expensive just to pay to make these products in China.
Right. Two things have happened. Wages in China have gone way up, you know, five times what they were just 10 years ago, and they are continuing to rise at about 20% a year. So let's throw one more on the table, which is not insignificant to your listeners, and that is the union that represents hourly workers in Louisville has agreed to reduce the starting wage. So whereas 20 years ago the starting wage was the equivalent of $21 an hour, people being hired now for the first time only make $13.50, $14 an hour. So that's a stat. So the labor costs in China going up, unions here have agreed to lower labor costs, and that is not insignificant either. That's an important part of keeping Louisville competitive.
So there's a whole list of issues here which factor in to this insourcing that you're talking about, oil prices, the cost of shipping the goods, the natural gas boom, all of the things that you've mentioned. But there's another also really interesting aspect. There's something else going on here, which is that by creating a product in which the engineer is nearby, the designer is nearby, and it's all happening at the same place, the builder is in communication with all the different parts of the company, we actually end up creating, as you write, a much more efficient product. Explain how that works.
You know, this is, I think, one of the most interesting elements of what they're doing in Louisville. They didn't just sort of take a spreadsheet and run the numbers and say, oh, it's cheaper, let's just do the same thing we were doing in China in Louisville. They actually reinvented the way they handle the products. And there's a really great example that they told me about. They're adding assembly lines really as quickly as they can. So we mentioned the water heater one, the refrigerator one. There's a new dishwasher assembly line coming online. It's for a high-end, expensive stainless steel dishwasher. And the way they organize their work now is that everybody is in the same room. They actually call it the big room. The people who put the product together, the people who design the product, the people who design the factory itself, the manufacturing people, and the marketers and salespeople who have to go out in the community, in the appliance world, and sell it, all work together in the same room. And they design this beautiful new dishwasher that they love, and there's four screws on the door. You open the door, and there's two screws on each side that are visible as you lower the door. And the marketing people said, boy, it's an iPhone world. Everybody wants products where there are no screws.
Hmm.
And the hourly wage people who put this thing together said, well, you know what? We hate screws. If you got screws, you're going to slip twice a shift and scratch the stainless steel with your screwdriver and throw that away and got to start again. And the design people for the dishwasher said, well, hey, if somebody told us that, that's fine. We can take the screws out. And they redesigned the door so that it has a bar and a hidden screw, easier to assemble. It does what the marketing people want. It looks even more beautiful than before. And the assembly line people say it's easier to put together, cheaper to put together, and there's no chance of damaging the product. So that's sort of the story of those four screws is exactly the advantage you have when you put everybody in the same room. That's exactly the conversation that just 1 year ago never would have happened. No one in China would have ever talked to anyone in Louisville. No one in Louisville would have ever talked to anyone in China. And so it's not just that they're making the stuff here. They're making it in a different way that they think means the products are better, closer to the customer, and easier to make and less expensive to make.
And this is, in a sense, revolutionary because in the last 20 years or even more, there was this idea that once you came up with a somewhat efficient design or a blueprint of how something is constructed, the thinking was like, well, just send it anywhere and they can make it. But this is a complete reversal now of that original thinking.
Exactly. It's really interesting that for years and years and years, even a company as smart and sophisticated as GE, and you can argue about a whole range of things, their impact on the environment and their employment policies and so forth, but they are a smart company, very analytical, very successful. They had just decided that the manufacturing wasn't really important at all. We design beautiful products. We send you the detailed blueprints if you're in Mexico, if you're in China, if you're in Vietnam, if you're in Taiwan, and you just make them as we told you to, and then everything will be okay. And what they have discovered is that the factory is itself a kind of research and development lab, that if you go every day, every other day, every week to the people who are putting the product together and say, how's it going? What problems have you got? What would be better? Those people instantly help you improve the quality of your product. And for the people at GE, like the manufacturing people and the design people who all work at Appliance Park, their ID badges 2 years ago didn't even open each other's areas of the facility. If you were a design person, you couldn't get into the manufacturing part. And if you were a manufacturing person, you couldn't get into there were literal silos. You were locked out of your own company's other divisions. Now these people literally all work in the same room together, and they have rediscovered that manufacturing is not only a talent and an art in itself, it's a way of helping you make better products if you listen. And so what was so hopeful for me was this isn't just a quirky thing that GE has done. If you do this right, it gives you a huge competitive advantage. And so other companies that make dishwashers and refrigerators, but all kinds of consumer products are going to have to say, what are they doing? We probably need to do that too if we're going to be competitive. And that's how you get, you know, the outsourcing cycle was we need to chase the lowest cost. And it would be nice if the insourcing cycle became a reverse sort of positive spiral where all kinds of people suddenly realized, wait a minute, I'm not really paying attention to what this is costing me. If I did it in the U.S., there are all kinds of ways I and my customers benefit, and so we're going to try and do that. You know, it might the negative spiral might actually become a positive spiral.
So we're seeing this in Louisville with the GE plant here. What are some other examples in the sense of where else is this happening in the United States?
Well, Airbus Industries just announced that it was going to build a huge aircraft assembly plant in Alabama. So for me, that's another perfect example. Airbus is a globally competitive company building incredibly. You know, there's nothing more complicated. Refrigerators are complicated, but they aren't as complicated as Airbus airplanes. It's an airplane. You can build it any, you can put it together anywhere. And they've chosen the U.S. in part to send a political message, but the economics are such that they can't afford to do this for quote-unquote, you know, patriotic reasons. So that's a great, you know, I thought that was a great example. But Otis Elevator, bringing factory back from Mexico, Whirlpool and Westinghouse, in fact, which are appliance competitors of GE, are bringing factories back to the Midwest, to Ohio and Michigan. My favorite example is Frisbee actually brought manufacturing of Frisbees, just plastic discs. There's really, I'm sure the Frisbee people would argue, but there's really nothing simpler, right, than a Frisbee,
right,
back from China to California to be, because the costs aren't that different, you don't have the transportation costs, and you can really be responsive to the market. So it's not, you don't look at the trade numbers or the manufacturing job numbers and say, wow, it's about to be 1973 again, right? In some ways, Louisville is a good example. A year ago, there were 1,600, 1,800 jobs at Appliance Park. Now there are 3,800. So they've hired 2,000 people in the last year, which is great. But 3,800 is not 23,000. And I don't think anybody at Appliance Park thinks they'll be at 23,000 anytime soon. So I think this is going to be slow, careful. It's not going to be like the mad rush overseas. But I think smart companies are going to realize that there's incredible advantages to making products, not just in the U.S., but in general in the markets where you're selling them. And so I think, I hope that what this means is that the bleeding has stopped, that manufacturing jobs will stop leaving the U.S., and that a whole class of smart, sophisticated manufacturing is going to come back to the U.S. Very famously, of course, right after this story came out, Apple announced that it would, you know, begin making some products back in the U.S. You know, very small investment, very small product line, but interesting that Apple felt like it was something it needed to pay attention to, and it's going to test it out and see what happens.
I'm curious, though, Charles, is there a fear that this cycle, though, could repeat itself, in the way that they retune the product itself, they get it back on the assembly line again, and then all of a sudden they think, well, maybe we'll still ship it somewhere else to make this thing again.
Right? Why not? Okay, now we've figured it out. Why not send it back to where the wages are low?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Well, that's, I mean, it's a great question. Why wouldn't this